You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
The Pet Doctor is brought to you by Dog.com. For everything and anything dog, shop Dog.com today for all the top brands. Greenies, Frontline, Kong, Nylabone, Royal Canin, and more. Shop at Dog.com and use the promo code SADDOC, S-A-D-D-O-C, and get $15 off your order of $75 or more.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
There are mornings when I get out of bed that I know I've fallen through a time warp and aged at least 20 years overnight. My back is killing me. Backaches are a common complaint of people. Just listen to all the advertisements on the radio. But humans are not the only species that suffer from this malady. Our cats and dogs are also plagued by slip discs, pinched nerves, and more. So what are the causes, and what can we as caregivers do to prevent these painful and often crippling conditions? My guest today is Dr. Wayne Berry, a diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine, Neurology. He practices at Southern California Veterinary Specialty Hospital in Southern California. The idea for this interview came from a listener, Brooke Payton. Thank you, Brooke. I appreciate the suggestion. And if you're listening and have a topic that you'd like me to address, please send your ideas to the Pet Doctor at PetLifeRadio.com. We'll be right back after this break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Celebrate your special occasion and give her this classic semi-eternity band created with 1-carat brilliant diamonds, channel set in 14-carat white gold. Exclusively yours from ICE.com. Free shipping over $150, free returns, and 30-day money-back guarantee.
Go to ICE.com and use promo code ACTFP and get 20% off your purchase. Or use promo code ADTFP and get 20% off at Diamond.com. ICE.com or Diamond.com. Get 20% off from Pet Life Radio.
Love your pets but wish their medications were a lot less expensive? They are at 1-800-PetMeds. You'll not only save on flea and heartworm medications, but on prescriptions for arthritis, incontinence, thyroid, and more. And you get fast service, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Plus, our licensed pharmacists ensure accuracy, monitor drug interaction, and more. See why over 5 million people have trusted their pet's health to 1-800-PetMeds, America's largest pet pharmacy. Call now or order online.
Go to PetMeds.com/doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, to get 10% off any order and free shipping on orders of $39 or more at PetMeds.com.
There's a movement afoot, ShoeBuy.com. Join the millions of people who shop ShoeBuy.com's over 400 brands and 500,000 products. Order now and get free shipping and free return shipping. ShoeBuy.com, the world's greatest shoe store.
Walk your dog in style and comfort. Enter the code DOCTOR, D-O-C-T-O-R, at checkout and get a 10% discount plus free shipping at ShoeBuy.com.
This year, Americans are expected to spend a jaw-dropping $36 billion on their pets. From lighted leashes to high-end spa products, the discriminating pet owner can find just about anything to pamper his or her pet. Hi, this is Michelle Fern. Join me every week for Best Bets for Pets, where we'll talk about the latest pet products and talk to the companies that make them. Best Bets for Pets, every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Yeah.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Barry, I think you'd agree that back problems are way too common in cats and dogs. But are they as common in cats and dogs as they are in people?
Well, not so much in cats, but certainly dogs. We see a significant number of dogs with back issues, back pain, weakness in the back legs, and very commonly in certain types of dog, acute paralysis.
They think of Dachshunds. What other breeds would be very prone to having sudden problems?
Well, the Dachshund-type breeds, and that's what we call chondrodystrophic breeds, in other words, the sort of stretched-out versions, long backs, short limbs, the sort of dwarf breed patients, they tend to have a different type of degeneration of their disc, and it often results in acute rupture of that disc material. When that disc material ruptures, it ends up causing compression of the spinal cord, weakness in the back legs, and often acute paralysis.
Why are those dogs more prone to it?
Well, they're more prone because it's actually a genetic predisposition. You know, over many, many generations, what we as man has done is select dogs for the way we want them to look. And I know this is a really simplistic explanation from me, but it's the way I see it is that, you know, if you have a dachshund that has a longer back and you want shorter legs and you want Dapple or you want the Merle gene in it, you're going to selectively breed those dogs. And as a result of that, we've selected dogs for the way we want them to look. And inadvertently, we've actually ended up concentrating some bad genes where there's early degeneration of discs.
So if we were to think of the prototype dog, you know, the one that looks more like the wolf, the Labrador Retriever, for instance, or the German Shepherd, it's not as prone then as the Dachshund for having those back problems.
Yes and no, and I'm sorry I can't be more specific than that, but, you know, if we look back at for example, the Labrador that you mentioned, breeders have done such a fantastic job in conjunction with their veterinarians in breeding away from hip dysplasia. But what is happening now is that we're seeing a lot more elbow dysplasia in some of those breeds. And that is because of these genes that creep in and they end up being concentrated as we control their breeding. But in some of those larger breed dogs, we are seeing similar degeneration of discs that used to only be associated with the Dachshund-type breeds. In other words, the dwarf breeds. So the degeneration of those discs is not limited to the dwarf breeds at all. And in actual fact, the other breed that you mentioned, the German Shepherd dog, we see a significant number of German Shepherd dogs with disc disease both in the middle part of their back at the junction between the thoracic and the lumbar spine and at the lumbar sacral spine where we will typically, as man, will typically have disc issues. And unfortunately, many of those German Shepherds are labeled as having degenerative myelopathy, and it's only when the patient has now continued to deteriorate for more than a year that suddenly we realize, oh, well, maybe this isn't degenerative myelopathy. Maybe this is due to compression of the spine.
A couple of weeks ago, you and your organization, the Southern California Veterinary Specialty Hospital, put on a marvelous continuing education program for local veterinarians. And one of the things that you brought up, and I think it's important for people to realize, that there's really a difference between our spine and a dog or a cat spine. Could you kind of tell us more about it?
Yeah, sure. You know, the most mobile area of our spine below the neck, I mean, our necks are very mobile, but then the spinal area between our, going down to the level of our shoulders or ends of our shoulder blades is fairly rigid. And then the flexible area is in the lumbar spine. That's why so many of us that, you know, are over 40 or 50 will have, you know, pain in the lower part of the spine is because those discs start degenerating. And if you imagine that the disc is shaped like a donut, so we take a donut, and in that central hole of the donut, we pack in a whole bunch of jello, and we put two bricks, on either side of that jello donut. The bricks actually represent the vertebral bodies, so they're the bone. The disc is represented by that jello donut, but that jello starts drying out. So imagine you put that jello in the fridge and it gets old and it gets crumbly. It's no longer a good shock absorber. And so what then happens is that the two bricks pressing on that disc actually flatten the disc, and the disc spreads 360 degrees. Where it spreads upwards in the dog, it ends up putting compression on the nerve roots in the lumbar spine. And that's what happens to us, is that the disc will often bulge out sideways, it puts pressure on the sciatic nerve rootlets, and it's extremely uncomfortable. We have this incredible pain, a muscle spasm, we're twisted, we then go for physical therapy or acupuncture, or we go on to medications to control the muscle spasm. We go on to pain medication, and we start feeling a lot better after a number of weeks. We change our lifestyle. And for many of us, we can avoid undergoing surgery because that pain actually arises mostly in us from the bulging of the disc. There are a lot more pain fibers in the disc in our backs than there are in dogs' backs. That's one of the differences. The second difference is that when that disc bulges in the lower part of our spine, it's going to put pressure on our nerve roots because our spines are so much shorter than dogs. Our spinal cord will end, you know, just below our shoulder blades, and then the nerve roots travel within that spinal canal before exiting and going to our legs. So when my disc at L4-5 or L5-S1 starts bulging, it puts pressure on nerve roots. So it's highly unlikely that it's going to paralyze me. Certainly makes me incredibly uncomfortable with muscle spasms and all that. But in the dog, the spinal cord is much, much longer. It ends right down at the bottom, and dogs have two extra vertebrae, L6 and L7. So the spinal cord ends in the dog around about L5, L6, and then the nerve roots travel through the remainder. But look at the way a dog runs. He runs arching his back. So that's where most of the wear and the tear of the disc is going to take place, is in the middle part of the back. So now when the disc bulges in the middle part of the spine, it's going to put pressure on the spinal cord, not on nerve roots. And the spinal cord just doesn't tolerate that.
That's a lot more dangerous.
Much more dangerous, absolutely. It's a very soft organ. That's why it's totally encased in bone to protect it. And so when the spinal cord gets compressed, that's when we start seeing the weakness in the back legs, and that eventually leads to paralysis in many patients.
There are so many times when a client will bring in a dog that has a painful back, and okay, they still have an idea, they can still walk, they're still putting pressure on all four legs, you touch that back, it's like, oh, don't even get near there. And you try to tell them this might be a surgical situation, and they give you this horrid look going, oh my goodness, either number one, they're afraid of surgery, or number two, their pocketbook's afraid of surgery. Is it okay to just say, here's medication, take it easy, or should veterinarians really stress that this is a surgical situation?
That's an interesting problem that we're always faced with. And you know, as pet owners, we're always concerned about putting our pets through a surgical procedure, and particularly spinal surgery. And the thing that always goes through our minds when we have our dog that has back pain is, let's just take away the pain. Let's treat symptomatically. Let's remove the pain. And, you know, hopefully things will improve and we can avoid a surgery. As a veterinarian, I mean, really all we can do is to educate our clients as to what the potential implications are. And one of the problems with trying to diagnose disc disease is just the expense of doing the diagnostics. It has to be done under anesthetic, and that's either by means of an MRI, and dogs won't lie still in an MRI machine. You know, some people won't even lie still in an MRI machine, but dogs certainly don't. So they need to be anesthetized. So, you know, that's part of the expense, so MRI or myelogram. And a myelogram is a dye study where we inject dye under a video x-ray technique, and we watch that dye as it colors in the spinal cord right up to the base of the skull. So that's what's required from a diagnostic point of view. From a therapeutic point of view, if we've got compression of the spinal cord, then the ideal is to decompress that spinal cord such that we can limit permanent damage and hopefully get recovery of that spinal cord. In the absence of being able to perform surgery or the diagnostics, we're very limited as to what we can do. We can basically treat symptomatically. In other words, we reduce the symptoms or the signs in the dog of back pain. And that is going to require analgesics, so painkillers, and sometimes anti-inflammatories. But where we as veterinarians need to just caution owners is that our patients could certainly feel much better when we take away that pain. And if we don't curtail their activity, and, you know, Fido starts jumping around because he feels great on his painkiller, he could potentially work more of that disc out underneath his spinal cord and then become paralyzed. Then it becomes an emergency to decompress that spine such that it can recover. There are many patients where surgery is not an option. I mean, we've got to live in the real world. You know, not everyone can afford expensive diagnostics and the surgical treatment. But the reality is that we can get exacerbation of the compression of the spine by treating medically. And that actually comes back to something that I didn't mention, Dr. Cruz, was that, you know, there's a difference in the nature of the disc degeneration as well. In particularly the dwarf breed dogs, that disc turns to mush. It's like toothpaste. And can you imagine standing on a tube of toothpaste? Eventually you're going to blow the cap off and toothpaste is going to squirt out. That squirts out underneath the spinal cord, and so it actually creates a mass effect. It squeezes the spine. And that's why many of these patients do require surgery, because that's the only way that you can get that material away is to actually physically remove it from around the spinal cord.
So we're doing such a better job of having our pets live longer. So it almost seems with some of these breeds, you would almost expect them to have these problems. They get older. If we're looking at this jelly donut that just degenerates over time. Now, you also mentioned that sometimes it's just a matter of we don't have that capability. Very fortunate here in Southern California, having, for instance, a facility such as yours, Southern California Veterinary Specialty Hospital, that we have the specialists such as you and the capability of doing MRIs. But there are places in the United States, the world, where people can't get MRIs easily. So sometimes, yes, we are left with, here's a pain pill, take it easy, don't get too active.
We certainly are very, very fortunate in being able to have access to this. And, you know, our culture is such that we want to be able to offer our pets that we see as members of our family. We want to offer them the same type of medical services that we can get. But it is quite interesting how long some of my clients have had to wait for an MRI or to even get permission from their insurance company to undergo an MRI. It's an interesting set of circumstances.
You'd mentioned earlier on that cats typically don't have the back problems that dogs do. Why is that?
You know, my glib answer is cats are not little dogs.
But that
that's
a good one.
Pretty much. I don't know why. They don't seem to undergo the same type of degeneration to the spine. I think that the stresses brought to the spine are somewhat different. I think cats' spinal columns are basically suspended a little differently from dogs between all four legs. But they, you know, I have seen on rare occasions acute disc ruptures with disc material that looks like toothpaste, very similar to that which would occur in a Dachshund or one of those similar breeds. So we do see it. It's just less common. And actually, when we do see disc disease in the cat, it's most commonly right down at the bottom of the spine at the L7-S1, so the last lumbar vertebra and the first sacrum, akin to what we would have with lumbar pain. But the cat's spinal cord is even longer than the dog's. So the cat's spinal cord actually ends behind that last disc. So, you know, we will occasionally see those patients, but it's not common. A lot of cats that we see with weakness in the back legs are either due to neuromuscular disease, so disease of the peripheral nerve, junction to muscle, or the muscle itself, or due to space-occupying lesions within the spine, such as cancerous growths, tumors.
I think probably some of it is because cats are always doing their Pilates, and cats typically aren't out there running, 3 miles with their owners. It probably makes some difference, too, or chasing Frisbees.
Yeah, you make a good point. I sometimes wonder whether we make our dogs do things that they were not originally designed to do.
Watching some of those dogs do agility and fly ball and flying in the air after Frisbees, like, oh, every time I watch that and watch a dog come down, it's like, oh, okay, they're still walking. That's good. But yes, it just seems like it's maybe not the best things for their little backs or for people to do some of the extreme sports.
It does, but you know what? They have such fun doing it. My gosh, you see these dogs? You can see they love it to pieces, and their owners get such a kick out of it too. And therein lies the challenge for us, isn't that in these agility dogs, when they do undergo surgery, talking to clients and owners, you want to say, listen, our athletic career is now over, because if you were a professional athlete and you underwent this type of surgery, your athletic career is now over. But for many of these dogs, their owners feel that if they can't do this type of athletic endeavor, their life is going to be miserable. And so therein lies the challenge, is to get them back into the agility, and it's very rewarding when we are able to do that. But, could it occur at a later date at another place? It's possible.
And that is one of my questions about the success of surgery. You hear people having back surgeons undergoing just numerous back surgeries and then have these pain pumps put in, so he's constantly getting medication. Are people less responsive to surgery, or you're just choosing your animals differently, your surgical candidates differently, and they're getting into surgery sooner because we don't have the insurance to contend with?
Yeah, I mean, there are many factors there. When you consult with a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic surgeon who is specialized in spinal surgery in the human field, they tend to warn people against surgery because of less than ideal recoveries. However, I think about 2 years ago there was a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I can't remember the exact details, but this was actually a group of people that had early surgery very early on in the course of their back disease, and the recovery rate was far superior to waiting and putting it off, because many, many people will feel that it's a procedure of last resort. By the time you do a procedure of last resort, there's so much scar tissue, there's so many dynamic changes that have taken place, there's so much permanent damage to nerve roots, maybe we should be doing these a lot more proactively. In the patients that we see, it's always a common question from owners, what is my dog going to be like after surgery? The majority of dogs that are paralyzed, that still have feeling in their toes, 96 to 97% of those dogs will be ambulatory after recovering from surgery. In other words, they will be able to walk. There will be, some degree of weakness or limping, but many dogs make, to all intents and purposes, a complete recovery. It depends on how much permanent damage has occurred to the spine. And if you were to say, right, what are the factors, just simply, what are the factors that determine the prognosis for recovery? I mean, the one is the speed with which that spinal cord gets bumped or bruised. If this is a volcanic eruption underneath the spinal cord and that toothpaste material is spewed out and it comes out under force and it bruises that spinal cord's going to have a longer recovery time than one where there's just been a slow ooze of disc material. But that's already happened. We can't control that factor. That happened, and that's why the dog is now presented at our front door. The second factor is how much compression has occurred to the spine. if you've got a small amount of disc material that's taking up space and compressing that spinal cord's going to have a much better chance of recovery when it's taken away than the spinal cord that has been squeezed 50 or 60% because of the big mass of disc material. But that's also a factor that we can't control. That's already happened. The only factor that we can control is the third factor, is how quickly that spinal cord is decompressed. The sooner the spinal cord is decompressed, the better chance there is of making a good recovery. And that's why we do a lot of these surgeries after hours, because we don't go to sleep on patients that are paralyzed. Patient is paralyzed, we come in, we attend to that, and we get it decompressed that night, early hours of the morning if that is necessary, because that's the way we stand the best possible chance of returning that patient to an ambulatory status.
And that's why sometimes a surgery costs much more than people think it's going to, especially when we're so used to having our own health insurance that covers these things. Right now we're talking to Dr. Wayne Berry. He's a diplomat at the American College of Veterinary Medicine, Internal Medicine, Neurology. We've been talking about spinal problems in dogs and cats. We're going to take a short break and be right back talking about what are maybe some other options for surgery and other diseases that may mask themselves or look like they're going to be neurological and maybe not. We'll be right back after this break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
At Petco, we really love pets. There isn't anything we won't do to make sure they're getting the best products and the best care. So when you ask us a question like,
"So how do you feel about cat condos?"
we can say from experience,
"Feels like home for her."
Enter the code DOCTOR10, DOCTOR, the number 10, and get 10% off any order. No minimum at Petco.com.
FTD's network of over 40,000 florists around the world have been creating beautiful handcrafted arrangements for 100 years. Each arrangement is delivered the same day and backed by FTD's 7-day satisfaction guarantee. For a century, people have trusted their most important occasions to the flower experts at FTD.
Since Pet Life Radio is all about puppy dogs and flowers, our listeners, that's you, can get a 20% discount on your order. Just go to florop.com and use the code DOCTOR20 at checkout. FLEUROP.com, code word DOCTOR and the number 20.
You ask the question, what do I want? What do I need? I'll take affection. Irene should mention, I need time. I need love. I crave attention.
Love My Pets, the new single by Mark Winter, available in iTunes.
Welcome to Sassy Seniors, a show about our fabulous older dogs and cats. I'm your host, Kelly Jackson. You know, I wanted to create a show to really showcase our senior pets. And, you know, as the human population ages and lives longer, of course, so are our wonderful pets. But many of us with aging pets, it's so interesting. We have a tough time realizing or really admitting that they are seniors. So, in a way, I kind of like to think of our senior pets as wise puppies. What do you think about that? Be sure to join us for another edition of Sassy Seniors. And remember, celebrate your senior pets.
Every week on demand. Only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Barry, you've just had some very fascinating things for us to learn about spinal differences in humans and dogs and why it's so important to get in there as quickly as possible to decompress a back if we've had a slip disc. Now, sometimes when people can't or don't want to go ahead and have surgery done, how about things like acupuncture or veterinary chiropractic medicine? Is there a reason, a good reason to do it? And what are some of the cautions that people need to consider?
Yeah, alternative therapies, I think, do have a role. However, I want to just countenance that with a big warning about chiropractic manipulation. Because of the difference in the nature of degeneration of that disc in dogs compared to people, manipulation, so physical manipulation of the spine, has to be done extremely judiciously, because that it's like having that tube of toothpaste that I described earlier, and the cap is off, and now you're fiddling with the tube and you're squeezing it and you're twisting and turning it, you're going to push more of that material out from the tube. And that's what can happen, and I've certainly seen this happen after chiropractic manipulation. There are other forms of acupuncture that are applied in veterinary medicine. You know, those are more applied to, with an applicator applied to pressure points, and I think that can play a role in reducing some muscle spasm. But you know, muscle spasm is not a huge problem within disc disease in dogs in the middle part of the back. Muscle spasm can certainly be a problem when there is lumbar sacral disc disease and compression of the nerve rootlets of the sciatic branches. But where there's compression of the spinal cord, muscle spasm isn't a major role. So, you know, I'm certainly a little skeptical that acupuncture plays, or even acupressure plays, a huge role in modulating, and certainly dogs may feel a bit more relaxed after having had that physical manipulation. It's like us going, you know, for a massage. It obviously releases some endorphins within the system, and we feel a lot better. The other thing that you mentioned was acupuncture, and I think that certainly acupuncture does play a role in veterinary medicine, but I think it is mostly in the role of control of chronic pain, and I think that's where acupuncture can play a role in reducing the amount of analgesic and anti-inflammatory medications that our patients have to take, reduce the potential side effects from those medications, and assist with the well-being and of the patient.
So it's good. It sounds like there is a role for alternative medicine.
Oh, I do believe there is. It's just, you know, one of the problems that we in Western medicine face is, one, a lack of knowledge and a lack of experience of alternative modalities, and I include myself in that group. But also, a perception that we as pet owners have is that, well, if we're going to go and have acupuncture, that's going to be a panacea for all our problems, and it's not. And so in many patients, I work with acupuncturists, I work with homeopaths, I work with people that use Chinese herbal medications. It's probably a marriage of both of Western and, or let's call it, traditional and non-traditional medicine. I don't think that there's any one that is going to be absolutely paramount, but certainly where you have compression of the spine, I'm afraid, you know, homeopathic medications and, you know, herbs are not going to take away that compression. That's a physical thing that needs to be removed.
Thank you. I really do appreciate that. And I also appreciate the fact that I'm set up this interview today with you because of the suggestion of one of the listeners, Brooke Payton. Now, hers was a little bit different. She wanted to know a bit more about limber tail in Labrador retrievers and the exercise-induced collapse, where someone would see this and may think that this is a neurological problem. I know this may be a little bit out of your realm, but could you address both of those situations, the limber tail that happens to some dogs?
Yeah, sure. Limber tail was a little bit confusing when we first saw some of these patients. And, you know, I haven't seen a great deal. I think they see a lot more in the Midwest, particularly in hunting dogs. And it's seen primarily within the Labrador and pointers. And essentially what happens is that suddenly a patient is presented with a tail that is drooping. It may stick out a little bit, you know, maybe 3 or 4 inches at its base, and then it just makes a 90-degree turn, and it is flaccid. It doesn't have any tone. Owners will also say that sometimes the hair at the base of the tail is elevated. And, you know, there are three sort of major predisposing factors that some researchers have put together. And the first one is that many of these dogs have had prolonged periods of being cramped in a pen or a crate, being transported either to some trial event or back from a trial event. And, you know, they've been sort of in one position in a limited area for a number of hours being transported. So that's the one factor. The second predisposing factor is commonly either unconditioned dogs, so unfit dogs that are suddenly vigorously exercised, or dogs that have done incredible overactivity, you know, have really gone out, all out, and had a hard day either training or performing as a trialist. And the third factor is that it's usually associated with some sort of either climate change, so cold temperatures, or as a result of having gotten wet. So these dogs are either put into their crate having been in the water and are still wet or certainly cold.
And it's not a painful situation.
You're absolutely right. It doesn't appear to be painful. But the good thing about this is that dogs make a spontaneous recovery. What is thought to occur is that this is like a compartmental type syndrome, where there is compression of the muscle, the groups of muscle of the tail, due to some fibrous band that may develop around the tail. You know, be it constriction of fascia around the muscles, sort of squeezing the muscles, and those muscles actually then undergo a degree of degeneration or necrosis. And necrosis is basically the term for death of those cells. And then those cells make a recovery. So the exact mechanism as to how it occurs, we're not quite sure of, but it is actually a muscle condition. It's not a nerve condition. And so, yes, many of these patients are seen, as you said, you know, suspected of having paralysis of the tail because of either a lumbar sacral disc, so a disc right down at L7S1 that is maybe acutely ruptured, and the dog's anal glands and anal sacculitis. And so those are things that are occasionally seen. Some people have complained and said, well, maybe it's a spider bite or anything of that nature. But, you know, in a dog that is a working dog, that is a field trialist, either a pointer or a Labrador, where there's vigorous movement of those, particularly the lateral tail muscles, we can see this syndrome. And, you know, if it's been associated with vigorous exercise, prolonged transport or being cooped up in a small cramped area, and particularly if they've recently had a bath or have been cold or wet, those are the things that would sort of clue one into thinking that this is in all probability limber tail. Now, in the acute phase, often we will see an increase in the release of muscle enzymes. So if your veterinarian does a blood chemistry analysis, often the creatine kinase, the CK, which is very easily released from muscles, will be elevated in the early part of the syndrome.
You're talking about these dogs being cold, wet, exercised hard, and I do sled dog medicine and don't do it every winter, but enough that I've found never seen this in these dogs, and these are dogs that are definitely in the cold. These are dogs that are in cramped areas after they've been run, for instance. They're put into their small little dog trucks, and I've never seen it, and I wonder why that's so. Somebody's going to have to do some research on that.
That is an excellent point, and you know, it brings one to think that, you know, maybe this is not entirely due to exercise or cold or transport or something, but maybe within those particular breeds there's a predisposition. It also brings us on to the other question that you asked, you know, what about the exercise-induced collapse? Well, if we look at the exercise-induced collapse syndrome that occurs in the Labrador, and more recently it's been a similar type of disease or syndrome has been recognized in the Border Collie, but they are different because in the Labrador, and this usually affects young adult Labradors, although it can affect some Labradors as young as 5-6 months of age, it is actually a genetic condition. And some really smart people up at the University of Minnesota have actually found the gene that will result in exercise-induced collapse. Do you want me to go on and discuss a little bit about
that? It looks like, and what people can do about it, which is basically not breed those animals, it sounds like.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, this is a condition that I think we sort of first started noticing around about middle of the 90s, where these Labradors would collapse, and often it was thought that these dogs were having a seizure. They were out exercising, and they would start getting wobbly in the back legs, and then, you know, some ataxia, incoordination in the front legs, and then they would go stiff in the back legs. Often these dogs, because they have such incredible drive to either catch the ball or do whatever the owner is wanting them to do as far as their training is concerned, many of these dogs will just drag those back legs and still keep going with the front legs, you know, almost like army crawl in some of them. And that's quite an important factor because it appears that many of these Labradors that have this condition have that incredible athletic desire. They are very excitable dogs. They're dogs that will do anything for their owners. And it's seen in all colors of Labradors, both sexes, and it's most commonly seen in field trial dogs that, you know, do really vigorous activity. And it seems as though there could be a preponderance in black males, but as far as I understand, you know, there's a preponderance of black male Labradors as field trials. So, you know, I'm not sure whether there is a predilection there. And as I said, anywhere, you know, usually young adults, 5 months to 3 years. And these are really athletic dogs. They're very fit. They're very muscular dogs.
Is there any treatment for this?
Mm-hmm. There isn't, actually. There is no specific treatment. Many of these dogs will have high rectal temperatures, and initially we thought that this was some form of malignant hypothermia, but that gene has been identified in dogs, and these dogs are negative for that gene, so it is not a malignant hypothermia. The other issue is that many of these, many normal dogs, you know, you take a normal Labrador retriever that does not have exercise induced, when they exercise, many of them will have a rectal temperature of 107 and above.
Oh my goodness. Being 101 to 102 and a half.
Right. So, you know, many of these dogs have high temperatures, and, you know, their temperatures come down at the same rate that a normal dog's temperature will come down. But the interesting factor is that many of these dogs that swim, that are retrieving items, balls, etc., in the water, many of those dogs don't develop the signs or symptoms of exercise-induced collapse, although there have been a few that have, and, you know, unfortunately one or two have drowned. But, you know, you mentioned, is there any treatment? I mean, basically you want to stop the patient from exercising as soon as we start seeing the signs of incoordination, wobbliness in the back legs, allow them to cool down, often, you know, just bathing them, cooling them, particularly if they're in a climate with a high environmental temperature or high humidity. Many dogs don't show any of these signs or develop this collapse until they change to an environment that they're not used to. They're not used to exercising in warm climate or in a very humid area. That can predispose them to the collapse. Try and avoid excitement and stress. And it also revolves around sort of trying to modify the type of exercise that the dog is undergoing. You know, continuous, very intense retrieval, very intense exercise will predispose a dog that has this this gene. And there's testing available for this gene at the University of Minnesota. So, you know, certainly breeders are submitting or subjecting their dogs to genetic testing to determine whether they have an affected patient or a patient at risk or a patient that is a carrier. That genetic result will basically give us three results. One is that they are unaffected and clear, which is great. That's the ideal. The second is that they have one of the two genes. These genes are all paired, so if they only have one of the two exercise-induced genes, which is called Dynamin 1, if they only have the one, then they are a carrier, which means their offspring. It's an autosomal recessive gene, so 50% of their offspring could be affected with exercise-induced collapse. And then if they have both of those genes, then they will, you know, be affected with the condition.
And I'm sure it does vary as to how severe the signs are. So even if they're carrying it or they pass it along, what's the degree that the offspring will show the disease if they have it? And as you were mentioning before, people doing such a wonderful job now with breeding out hip dysplasia in Labradors, but oh, by the way, we got rid of that, but now we're concentrating elbow dysplasia. So genetics is a very difficult field to understand. I get rid of one thing, but I may be getting another.
Right. As far as treating these patients is concerned, Dr. Cruz, and, you know, we said the one thing is to avoid intense exercise and maybe break it up into shorter periods, try not to exercise during hot times of the day, and try and avoid high humidity. The other things that have been advised, the use of antioxidants may reduce oxidant stress and just maybe help with muscle metabolism. And so, you know, some people would advise coenzyme Q. We're not sure that it does much for these patients. The other nutraceutical that is often used is a cofactor, which is L-carnitine. Basically helps with the metabolism of the muscle, entry of fatty acids into the mitochondria. And so just the energy factory within the muscle is helped with some of these preparations. And whether it does do any good or not, only time will tell. There's some anecdotal information about 7-keto, K-E-T-O, which is basically a breakdown product of a hormone. But it's anecdote. No one has shown any conclusive results on that. One other thing that is reported is the use of phenobarbital.
Huh.
Now, that initially, I think, occurred because some of these dogs looked as though when they were thrashing around and they were so confused because they were suddenly paralyzed and they couldn't get up and move, phenobarbital was initiated, and some of those dogs actually responded, even though it was at a fairly low dose, low concentration. We don't know what that mechanism is, but it may actually just be that the phenobarbital, although it's an anticonvulsant, is not actually having an anticonvulsant effect, but is actually anxiolytic. In other words, it's reducing the level of anxiety within the patient. Because remember, I said that these dogs are usually, you know, high-energy, athletic dogs that, you know, are very excitable. So maybe just taking the edge off their excitement with phenobarbital has helped some of these dogs cope with the condition. I think the jury's still out on that.
Well, Dr. Berry, this has been very exciting because you've given us some fascinating information a lot of people would have no idea. I know every time I listen to you, I learn more things. And I know more times than not when somebody says, no, my pet has a painful back, let's just go ahead and treat, I now realize, no, I need to be much more aggressive with these people, trying to convince them that this may not be in their pet's best interest. So, Dr. Berry, thank you very much for all your information and your time today. Hopefully people who've been listening have learned more about their pet's health. If you do have any questions, best person to ask is always your own veterinarian, but please feel free to contact me at the Pet Doctor at Pet Life Radio. So listen again next week. We'll have more information on ways to make you the best possible pet owner you can be. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.